Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for November 18th, 2018. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
And sitting in, Catherine Smith, for the entire show, a frequent guest but first-time guest host of the Kudzu Vine, Steen Kirby. Welcome, Steen.
Hey, everybody. Great to be on. Appreciate it.
All right. Good to have you on. Well, Steen, we're going to get right into your wheelhouse pretty quickly, but we'll start off statewide here in Georgia. And one of the final races to be called, resolved, whatever terminology you want to use, was the Georgia governor's race. They had to finish counting all the votes or count enough to know that there was no chance of a recount or of a runoff, either one. I guess there could have been a recount that would have forced a runoff, which who knows how that would have all fallen in. But it went very, very long because it was the closest governor's race since 1966, quite some time ago. But Stacey Abrams, she really didn't concede, but she said the outcome's going to be what the outcome is, but I don't want things to happen like they have in the past. Tim, just kind of since the election day to today, kind of give us your thoughts on how Stacey Abrams and and Brian Kemp, for that matter, and just the whole election has unfolded.
Well, as far as the governor's race, I mean, it's been television drama with people tuning in all the time. A lot of stuff going on the social media. This race went on and on and on and on to the point at the end where you started actually hearing some rumblings of people saying, you know, I wish this would just be over. I'm getting a little weary of it. There was talk of Abrams refusing to call the election over at all. And suing, and we'll get more on that in a minute, along with the concession speech that wasn't really one. And in the meantime, Brian Kemp was pretty much, he declared himself the winner, acting like, you know, I'm the governor-elect, and he started setting up his transition team, getting photographed with the governor, and all of that. In the meantime, we had two statewide races to go into runoffs. I'm fairly happy with the results in Georgia. We won a congressional district. More on that in a minute. We picked up seats in the legislature, 11, as a matter of fact, in the House and a couple in the Senate. And where we really made hay was in the North Atlanta suburbs up there. I think something like 13 of our 14 flips were in that area. Somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's where we really, really made some hay, in North Atlanta and up in its suburbs, as educated voters started turning away from Trump and the Republicans. So that's some of the takeaways I got between Election Day and this day.
Yes. Steen, just looking across the state, what were your thoughts, particularly on the governor's race? We hadn't even had your thoughts on the whole election, so you can go back a little further than Tim, since he had his chance last week to talk about that too.
Sure. Well, I definitely think that, you know, the further change in coalition between the more college-educated and suburbanite voters shifting to the left and, you know, becoming more Democratic, and rural voters, particularly rural whites, shifting even more conservative and more towards the Republican and Trump-style candidates is further clear in Georgia and pretty much everywhere else. Kemp, you know, did what he needed to do to win, which was maximize that rural turnout and that rural voter base, get, you know, just enough people in the Atlanta area and other metropolitan areas like Macon and Augusta to simply, you know, stay in the game, so to speak. And, you know, he did what he could do to win the election. And obviously Abrams, you know, got probably the margin that she would have wanted or been aiming for in Atlanta and other urban centers, but did not anticipate the drop off of support for herself in particularly the Black Belt counties, the rural counties that have significant African-American populations. And then just, you know, generally speaking, failing to make inroads in places like Whitfield County, Hall County, Forsyth, you know, sort of the semi-rural, semi, or, you know, becoming more suburbanized counties where, you know, they did put in effort and resources and they did move, but not enough, obviously, for her to reach the 50% margin that she was aiming to get. So the polls were correct. You know, it was 1 or 2 points either way, but the Republican turnout went up just enough to negate all the additional voters that Abrams was able to rally to the polls that maybe other types of candidates or other types of campaigns would not have been able to do. I mean, the thing that stuck out to me is for everybody that, you know, wants to object about Kemp's behavior or tactics, the number of raw votes that he got, 1.9 million something or another number after that, was significantly more than, for example, Nathan Deal ever got in terms of raw vote. So even though the election was closer than ever, he obviously was able to get somebody to the polls to vote for him. Otherwise, Abrams' turnout surge would have completely negated his ability to win. So they were able to rally their people to the polls, and, you know, even though everybody, you know, wanted to highlight the Abrams motivation and turnout operation, it really seemed like the Georgia GOP and the Kemp operation actually came through. At least in the race for governor and some of the statewide offices.
Yeah, I do think this is a complex set of numbers, and there's a lot to study here if you want to break through in 2022, even in 2020 in the Senate race, because while it is governor's race and U.S. Senate are very different offices, the way you approach winning the office is more similar. You know, like you mentioned Nathan Deal, I think Nathan Deal was a far stronger candidate, even in 2010 when he wasn't the incumbent, than Brian Kemp was. I also think 2010 and 2014 were just far better Republican years than this year. Now, Stacey Abrams, she did do a great job boosting the turnout in a lot of metro counties, moving those counties Democratic. We're going to talk about one of those, Gwinnett, in a minute, because if I'm not mistaken, Cobb County had already moved to the Democratic side in the presidential election, but Gwinnett hadn't.
Gwinnett voted for Clinton.
So they had already moved, but you were right. You mentioned that some of these rural counties, and some of the rural counties with a decent-sized African-American population in South Georgia, that they moved more towards the Republicans, places with a good-sized minority population, and that's what's so frustrating. I mean, we can see some of the, you know, Mountain Georgia counties that are, you know, 98% white, you know, moving away. That could have been predicted, but some of the other ones, those were disappointing. But let's kind of get into Gwinnett. Gwinnett had a ton of state House and state Senate seats that moved Democratic. I believe there may have been some county commissions, some school board seats that flipped. And Stacey Abrams, she's the first Democrat to win the governor's vote in many, many years in Gwinnett County. Steen, what's going on in Gwinnett County?
Well, population change and being accelerated by a change in sentiment among college-educated whites is making it very hostile territory for the Republicans very quickly. As you mentioned, they picked up two county commission seats, which is the first time they've had a seat on the commission, period, since, I believe, the 1980s, maybe the early 90s. It's been a while. They also picked up one school board seat, and then the other school board seat is going to a recount. The Republicans ahead, but by less than a quarter of a percent. And then they picked up, I want to say, 4 or 5 state house races, and then two seats in the state senate, and then a third seat in the state senate was within 5 points. So simply put, you know, it was very much a wipeout. I believe the local county party on the Republican side is going to have a change in leadership coming up, and you know, they've just failed to cultivate and recruit more diverse candidates and people that can connect with the types of voters who now live in the county and are voting in the county. And I just think that, you know, even if the local incumbents have a decent record and they're not, you know, unethical people on paper, it's not going to be enough because they're not connecting with the voters who now live here. We've had an influx of, you know, diverse populations, immigrants, African-Americans coming out of Atlanta, people coming from other states like Florida and, you know, Chicago and New York and, you know, places like that coming down here that have a different set of values and background. And you can't run your campaign by visiting the Baptist Church and the Rotary Club anymore. It's just not that kind of county. And that's kind of where they're at. And then, you know, for the Democratic side, obviously the change in voter pattern has also increased the participation on the organizational side. So you have more groups and more people that are, you know, knocking on doors, sending out postcards, making phone calls, and doing all the things that make a campaign operate effectively. There was a candidate that I can't put the exact amount, but I want to say he spent less than $5,000. And he won a state house seat that was, you know, not projected to flip. And I want to say his opponent spent well over $50,000. So that just gives you an idea of it's not even necessarily the professionalism of the campaign. A lot of it is just people just want what they want. You know, they want something. They want a person that agrees with them. And if their representation doesn't agree with them, then they're not going to vote for that person, period.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing to win a state house seat for $5,000. The last county seat on the ballot in a small county usually costs more than $5,000.
They also picked up, we had one countywide race for the solicitor, which is, again, sort of a legal court position, and the solicitor was won by a Democrat countywide as well, beat a Republican incumbent for solicitor.
Yeah, well, I'm going to let Tim ask some questions on Gwinnett as well while we're on this part. Tim's questions for Steen on Gwinnett County and the change.
Yeah, Steen, one obvious question I wanted to ask about, I understand all the changes that are happening in Gwinnett County, but then let's factor in Donald Trump, because something like 60% of the American people said their vote, in a lot of ways, was based on for or against Donald Trump, a support for him or a vote against him.
Sure.
Do you think that was a factor in Gwinnett County as well?
It definitely is, in the sense of, you know, underperforms the party line, so to speak. I mean, that's why, for example, Clinton won Gwinnett County, but so did Johnny Isaacson in the last election. So Trump
mm-hmm.
doesn't help. But I also think that you have people that are not Trump-style Republicans in the county who are still not doing very well. For
mm-hmm.
example, Scott Hilton, who lost to Beth Moore in the Duluth area, kind of West Gwinnett County, you know, he was not an example of somebody who was on the Tea Party, you know, far-right type group. He lost, you know, but then you also had someone like a Janet Mahaffey or Clay Cox, both of whom were, you know, more running to the right, more embracing Trump. Cox, you know, famously said he would vote for Trump twice in one election if he could do it. And he
mm-hmm.
lost as well. So I can't point to any of the outcomes in the county and go, this person lost the election because of Trump. I think they
mm-hmm.
lost the election because of the overall demographic change. I mean, simply put, when the white vote share of the electorate drops below 60%, the Republicans have a real problem. because they're just not doing well enough among people who are not, you know, not white to be able to win the election. It's just the math doesn't work for them anymore.
Well, Steen, a little over 60% of the residents of the county now are either African American, Latino, or Asian.
Yes.
Does that stat alone indicate that Gwinnett might become a reliably blue county for quite some time?
Absolutely, because you know that trend is probably not going to change. And even still, for as much as they have won, there's more on the table, you know, in coming elections to pick up other commission seats, legislative seats, etc. And you still have pockets of low turnout for the Hispanic population. Their numbers in terms of registration and participation are still well below their adult population in the county. So if that group, for example, is mobilized more effectively, it's only going to add to the strength of the Democratic coalition in the county. So to answer your question, yes, I don't see a way to reverse this unless you see the Republicans embrace a very different set of priorities and policies, which, I mean, certainly is not going to happen under Kemp, most likely. You know, you would have to have a Larry Hogan-style Republican, you know, more moderate, somebody that's a problem solver and a bridge builder to come in there and rebrand the party. But, you know, as you know, rebrands are not easy. And as long as you have someone like Donald Trump to make into a boogeyman, it's not going to really probably be very effective to begin with.
Yeah. I got one more question, and then I'll throw it back to David to take us in another direction. But I can't leave the subject of Gwinnett County without talking about the 7th district race for just a moment. I don't believe David was as surprised as I was by the result, but, I mean, what all literally held on by his fingernails, barely 400 votes. If the Republicans, while they still controlled the legislature, do not sit down and redraw that district in a far more favorable way for Republicans, are we looking at a situation where Woodall is basically DOA for the 2020 election?
Yeah, he's either going to have to retire, or he's going to have to embrace a different style of campaigning, or they're going to primary him out of there because they're not going to let him, you know, drag his feet on campaigning again. Now, the irony is, I think not campaigning probably saved his seat, because people did not see him. They did not hear from him. It was not in the forefront of their minds about the priority being to defeat him. And he had a relatively low charisma challenger as well. So I think the irony is, I could easily point to the 400 whatever vote margin and go, the guy purely won because he was inoffensive to people and they didn't know who he was. If he had been a Karen Handel style character where, you know, very high name ID, very polarized views, he probably would have lost because Abrams won that congressional district over Kemp. So Woodall actually, you know, won the district while Abrams won the district. So he kind of got lucky, but that's not going to last. I mean, it's just clearly not going to last.
I mean, does he automatically not become target number one among Republican elected officials in this entire state for Democrats?
He absolutely will be, and his voting record and behavior will be far more scrutinized than it has been previously. But, you know, I think at the same time, he's probably going to get, if he intends to actually make an effort to save his job, he will get additional resources and support this election he did not get this time. He didn't get PAC advertising this time and things like that. So, you know, it could go both ways. Because this is the first time that he's really been tested.
Okay, then. Take it away, David. Yeah, I'm going to piggyback on two responses you had to Tim's questions. And the first one was, you mentioned Asian Americans in Gwinnett County, and I think Gwinnett County has maybe the largest, at least percent, of Asian American voters in Georgia. I noticed in polling and exit polling, Asian Americans are now more Democratic than are Latino and Latina Americans. They're the second most Democratic racial group after African Americans. Any ideas? I mean, I know you're not Asian American, but you live in Gwinnett County, at least from the Gwinnett County experience. Why have Asian Americans become so Democratic reliably?
I mean, simply put, I think it's a backlash to xenophobia. The thing about it is, I mean, having polled and talked to a lot of Asian Americans of all backgrounds and of all different age groups and demographics and so on and so forth, they have values in many ways that would align with the Republican Party. They like low taxes. They like very good, you know, very good schools. They like school choice. They are not major fans of affirmative action programs. That's obviously been a big issue in California. That's been, you know, for the Asian community. They love business entrepreneurship and you know, business growth and promoting a, you know, pro-business climate. But they do not like, you know, when people are insulting their community and their background and you know, making a mockery of their lives. And I think you have too many Republicans that have embraced that type of tactic, like attacking birthright citizenship, you know, talking about, you know, supporting quote-unquote real Americans and that type of language that, you know, really has alienated that group. While at the same time, you have a lot of Democratic candidates that across the country and in Georgia have made at least some concerted effort to include that population in their coalition. They, you know, they will meet with the leadership. They'll talk to people. They'll attend the religious services and meet with the business community. And if the Republicans either are not doing that or they're doing that while at the same time, you know, engaging in race baiting and those types of behaviors, the community is going to be like, well, I don't know. So the fact is, you know, of all the groups, even more than Latino or African American, the Asian vote is still up for grabs. I mean, they voted for George Bush. They voted for, you know, a lot of other Republicans in recent memory. But they just do not embrace this Trump-style behavior because they feel like, you know, by empowering that type of candidacy, you're going to get things like the alt-right, which just does not jive with their values and what they want to see in the community. They want to feel welcomed and appreciated, not isolated and singled out.
Yes, I guess they're seeing how Donald Trump has treated other racial minorities, and why would they not be next if people have these feelings?
Yeah, when you're whipping up an angry mob and you know the mob could turn on you, you're probably not going to vote for the person whipping up the mob.
Yes. Well, let me go back to the Georgia 7th District, and that was interesting. You said that Stacey Abrams actually won that district, and Carolyn Bordeaux came close but didn't quite win it. Now, I get the sense that the average Republican insiders, they like Karen Handel more than Rob Woodall. They liked her more before this race, and they probably like her more even after this campaign. And if you look at the 6th and the 7th district, there are parts of that district that are – each district that are very Republican and parts that have trended heavily Democratic. And now, of course, the Republicans just 2 years away from census level redistricting could, you know, really change the maps up and try to, you know, maximize and mess around with Collins districts, Graves districts, Barry Loudermilk's district, and try to, you know, win both of those districts, Democrat or for Republicans. But to me, the better idea would probably be. Let's win one and let's just give up one. If they were to give up one, do you think there would be a map where they tried to go north and south and take that Forsyth County part out of the 7th district, put it in with some of the more northern Fulton and East Cobb areas of the 6th district, make a new reliably Republican district for the time being, and then just make a district that's probably just as Democratic as Hank Johnson's district? And if they were to do that, would it be set up for Karen Handel to then primary Rob Woodall, since they pretty much prefer her, at least the insiders, everything I see?
Well, the most logical thing to do is to give Gwinnett County its own congressional district, because the county is certainly big enough to have earned that designation. And, you know, obviously it's a community of interest. So that's probably, if Georgia gains another congressional seat, which it's supposed to be based on the census, they will probably just draw a Gwinnett County seat. And then at that point, that'll be, you know, a Democratic seat just based on the demographics of the county. Obviously, like you said, that would open up them to be able to draw Forsyth County in with the more northern parts of the Atlanta suburbs that are more Republican still, and maintain the, you know, the congruity of that district being red. The only other option they have is obviously to take 7th and the 6th, and take the 6th to the west and the north, and take the 7th either into Walton County or Barrow County, or further north into Forsyth. But I think that's less likely. So short answer is, I don't know what will happen with Woodall and Handel. I don't know if Handel even wants to do this again after going through two, you know, very exhausting elections for her and her family. But at the end of the day, I think they're going to end up giving Gwinnett County its own seat, just like, you know, Fulton County has a congressional district and DeKalb County has, for the most part, a congressional district at this point. I've also had some people, you know, talk about they're going to draw DeKalb out of the 6th district because they don't want the DeKalb delegation to be two Democrats. They want it to be one Democrat. So that's another thing that I've heard, is because McBath's margin mainly came from DeKalb County, they may just cut DeKalb out of the 6th district from now on.
I think there are probably other tools, but 538 has something, and you can mess around with the numbers, and you could go down to 3 Democrats if you made it the most Republican district. You could go up to 8 Democrats if you made the most Democratic districts. Now, I'm not sure exactly how reliable that is compared to redistricting software, but there obviously are some ways that they could take these mega Republican districts like Collins and Graves, move some votes around, and give some other folks, you know, to probably keep it, either secure the 7th or flip back the 6th, or possibly both. But I think one of those would be pretty short-lived, and then they'd be having another swing district on their hands.
The thing about Georgia is because of our black population, you have to have a certain number of VRA districts, and they can't get rid of those. So they can only do so much, because they still have to maintain those communities of interest being, you know, majority minority districts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could in the south end of Georgia, where Sanford Bishop is, you could do what they did with Gerald Green. Gerald Green is in a majority minority district in the state house, and he's a Republican. He switched parties. He was many years ago as a Democrat, switched parties, and still holds on to his seat, even though his seat is majority minority, which is very odd. But I think they could somehow look at still keeping Sanford Bishop's district majority minority, but still have Republicans, because it would be where minorities don't vote in the same numbers they do, say, in Metro Atlanta. Well,
absolutely.
Let's move this conversation to something totally different. And there is one more federal election this time. Mississippi has a special election. Mike Espy, former congressman, commissioner of agriculture, our secretary of agriculture, is the Democratic nominee. Cindy Hyde-Smith, who was appointed to fill the term of the previous senator, I want to say Thad Cochran, maybe.
Cochran.
I think that's who it is. Cochran. Yeah. She's trying to win her own full term. And it didn't look like it was going to be that big a race, given that Mississippi has a Republican lean. But Cindy Hyde-Smith has really been getting in her own way, Tim. How do you see this race right now?
Well, it was supposed to be an easy victory for the GOP, but the GOP concern is growing. You can see in their body language almost that it's growing. Even Trump is going to come in there and do two rallies in one night, right before Election Day. GOP private polling apparently shows this race tightening, and of course now, as we've seen, she hasn't helped anything with these verbal gaffes of hers. I mean, speaking of being willing to join a big supporter on the front row of a public canyon when she's running against an African-American in a state that has had the most lynchings of any state in the United States. To make matters worse, she totally botched the dealing with the fallout of this thing. I saw on TV the other day, a gaggle of reporters had her surrounded asking her about it, and she just kept repeating over and over and over, "We've already made a statement." Well, that didn't come across looking very good. Then there was the voter suppression statement, you know, about liberals at college and maybe we shouldn't let them vote. And again, that was badly mangled. I do know that the Republican National Committee has sent in 24 staffers. The National Republican Senatorial Committee has put up, I think, about $750,000 in ad buys. And the Democrats are suddenly pouring in resources from outside the district. Mississippi has had no Democrat elected to the Senate since 1982. Trump won this state by 18 points. Here's the deal. SB needs about 30% of the white vote to win. He got 21% on November the 6th. I still think it's her election to lose, but it's not going to be a cakewalk now.
Yeah. Now, Steen, we have to be fair. She said hanging, not lynching. And a lot of people know the difference is you have a trial, and hanging's a form of execution. Lynching is when you don't have the trial. You just skip the trial, and you basically murder someone, I mean, because you didn't give them due process. But here's the thing. If you're having to explain the difference between a hanging and a lynching, you're losing, correct?
Well, pretty much. You know, Hyde Smith was not a politically tested candidate. You know, she was an appointee. She was not elected to anything. You know, I don't think that she's used to this kind of a spotlight. And as far as I can tell, the things that have damaged her have basically been, you know, hot mic gaffes. It's not been, you know, it's not like she intentionally thought what she was saying was offensive. It just came out that way. And she lacked the experience and the, you know, sort of political acumen to know that those types of statements would be, if nothing else, spun by the news media. even if the intentions were not as bad as some people would want to suggest, you have to know that if, like you said, if you're talking about those types of things, you're already losing. You're not going to gain
Steen.
Any votes with those kind of statements.
Steen, can I throw in a question right there for
sure.
you?
Yeah.
I mean, you've run a lot of campaigns.
Yeah.
Where's your campaign staff in all of this? Shouldn't they be straightening some of this out?
And that's my point. It strikes me as the Republican reaction to this is a large part of blowback of suddenly realizing that she did not have a competent operation to begin with, which is why she's in this position. And, you know, they're obviously trying to shore her up. I mean, but you know, again, this is sort of being more safe than sorry, because they know that, you know, they saw what happened in Alabama, and obviously what cost them in Alabama was not some incredible Democrat. It was a Republican who simply could not keep his foot out of his mouth. And you know, obviously just hits kept coming, and, you know, he could not conduct himself professionally. So they're worried about that happening again, obviously, to an extent. And I think they also know that they've been through this before. I mean, in Florida, they had Ron DeSantis, who, when he won that primary, he was very much a creature of Fox News and the Trump media groups, and he was not prepared for being in prime time. And he made a comment that was seen by many as racist about, you know, we can't monkey this up in Florida, when he was running against an African American candidate. That obviously hit the news media. And then he also got kind of busted for being involved with some groups that were, you know, on the radical right fringe, you know, hate groups, so to speak. So, but DeSantis won in large part because the Republicans came in and stabilized his operation. So I think they're trying to do that again. And I also think that Mississippi is a classic high floor, low ceiling state for a Democrat because you have so many African Americans. You can only do so bad. And Espy is obviously a credible enough candidate with enough of a background that he's going to get a certain number of votes, period. But his ceiling is obviously very low, so he might just barely get 50, but that's about the best you can hope for. Now, one little fun fact a lot of people don't know, Espy became a political sort of, you know, maven in the state running funeral homes. The Espy family is big into funeral homes, and that's how they made the name for themselves.
Huh. Yeah, well, and in Georgia, I remember at one point the Georgia legislature had a ton of funeral home directors. It was almost the second most common population or occupation after a lawyer while there. Back when I started working in Georgia politics, amazing thing there. Well, and I tell you, I get the sense that Cindy Hyde Smith and a lot of her campaign seems to be running the playbook that Ross Barnett would have been comfortable with between the 50s and the 60s, and this is the 2000 teens. And it's just amazing that seems like the kind of campaign she's running. And then Phil Bryant with his defense, the governor, it was about just as tone deaf. And I do know there's a population in Mississippi that wants to move itself forward, that doesn't want to be what we saw in Mississippi burning and all those negative things back during the civil rights movement. Tim, do you think that kind of Cindy Hyde Smith is a little bit of a kind of lost in time, if you will?
You know, I think maybe Steen has a better angle. I would go with the word naive here. This person looks like a person who has been thrust into high political office with no concept, really, as to how to conduct themselves. Kind of sounds like 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, but not on so grand a scale. But I really believe she said these things and never gave it a thought, and then she didn't know how to handle it when it was time to explain herself, especially to experienced reporters that were waiting for answers. And the more she talked, the worse it got for her, and it actually turned a race that's not so close into a race that is close. I do believe Mississippi does have that group of people that you're talking about. I met some of them when I was out there a couple of years ago, especially like over in the Vicksburg area and over in there. So that state is trying to move forward a little bit. And you made an interesting observation, David, to me the other night when we were texting. It would be interesting, wouldn't it, if we woke up in a couple of weeks and both Mississippi and Alabama had Democratic senators and Georgia doesn't.
And Louisiana has a Democratic governor.
Yeah.
Just throw that in the house.
Oh, yeah, and they definitely do. And I think that the common theme in a lot of these races is David Vitter was a deeply flawed candidate. Roy Moore was a beyond deeply flawed candidate. And Cindy Hyde Smith, if this campaign goes on long enough, she might be a deeply flawed candidate even more so than she is now. I will defend her a little bit, Tim. I will say this. If you thrust her in the presidency, I do think she would listen to her advisors far more than the current occupant does, because I don't think he listens to anybody, and that's his biggest problem. Well, let's go ahead and move on to other things. And, Tim, you got just a bunch of demographic information about the campaign, and we're going to have some kind of method to go about this. So let's go all the way over to the Pacific Coast. We almost never discuss California politics, but this year the Republicans just got wiped out, in particularly in Orange County, which was many ways the foundation and the cradle of the Reagan Revolution and later Pete Wilson. And even when Arnold Schwarzenegger won that recall election and then served, you know, Orange County was one of the Republican bases. It's pretty much all the way gone now. Tim, what did you find kind of caused that? And there may have been some trends that are kind of national, not just specific to that one area of California.
Well, in California, boy, Pete Wilson really opened a can of worms a few years ago. Ronald Reagan himself, and going back to the days of Goldwater, how popular he was in Orange County, California. They had at one time the largest chapter of the John Birch Society in the United States, right there in Orange County. There was like 25,000 members of that organization nationally, and like 40% of them were in that county. Ronald Reagan himself said that Orange County was the place where good Republicans go to die. You know, that's how revered that county was in Republican circles. Even when Hillary Clinton carried that county in 2016, the Republicans still had four of the six congressionals there. Well, the 39th was called just in the last day or two, and there are going to be no Republican Congress critters coming out of Orange County. In California itself, the state Republican Party is literally on its knees. They are about to drop to third in rankings of parties behind Democrats and independents. Imagine the Republican Party in the biggest county in I was hearing somebody else talking. Okay. But the Republican Party's dropping this. They're in the largest state in the country where one in nine people live. The Republican Party can't even outnumber independents. California is now a majority-minority state. Orange County that we were talking about, guys, was 80% white in 1984 when Ronald Reagan made that statement. It's 40% white now. And the Republican Party, therefore, is just about to be wiped out there because basically Pete Wilson took care of any support among minorities coming toward the Republicans many years ago. So that party is in real danger. One Republican state official said the Republican Party just about is in a death spiral in California from which they cannot emerge. So that's where it stands.
Yes, and we know that some of their voters have moved on, like we saw about Texas. Californians that moved to Texas actually still are Republican, but they're not voting
right
in California anymore. And so that's kind of changed things. Then, of course, in Silicon Valley, you probably still have a decent number of white voters, but they are Democratic because they fit that highly educated, understand and respect science voter that has also left the GOP.
Well, David,
or has
David,
started
David,
voting in bigger
David,
numbers.
They're still very Republican in the Inland Empire area, you know, in the eastern part of the state. The problem is all the populations out toward the coast. And that's just as blue as blue can be, and they totally dominate the state.
Yeah, where people are. Yeah, the Republicans love to point to a land where there are more sheep than people, and I don't know what there is out there. Probably Death Valley, which that means maybe cacti or petrified wood or something that doesn't vote. Steen, you probably observed the how California's gone. Your thoughts on that, and what does that portend for the rest of the country? Given because of California's population, it really does drive a lot of different things about America, just because if you want to sell products or whatever in California, then you're going to then have it be that way for the rest of the country.
Yeah, I mean, California is another state where, the changing demographics and, frankly, change in values among different generational groups is helping the Democrats pretty much everywhere in the state. Mm-hmm. And it's another state where the Republicans are, probably were overperforming for quite some time simply because you had, sort of nascent populations that were not voting. You have a lot of Latino voters and places like Orange County and Fresno and places like that, if they show up at the polls, which obviously in many cases they did this year, it's a big boon for Democratic hopes. And if they stay home, it's obviously not. So, those seats were kind of due to flip, but once the money started to come in and once a lot of the Republicans were running, were just not prepared for, what was coming. I mean, someone like Dana Rohrabacher, it's just not an effective congressman. I mean, he spent more time talking and defending, WikiLeaks and Julian Assange when he probably should have been tending to his own backyard. So some of the people who lost, like Diane Harkey, the Daryl Issa seat that was, an open seat that Diane Harkey lost. Like I said, Rohrabacher, Mimi Walters, these were not incredible Republican candidates. But then, you also have people like Young Kim, who was a Korean American, and she was actually a pretty good candidate for the GOP, kind of a different background than they traditionally recruit. She was a woman, she was Korean. She had a background sort of fighting for issues impacting her community and her group, the Asian community. But obviously it still wasn't enough. So, once again, I think across the country you just see a realignment, and until the Republicans have a different brand at the highest level than the Trump brand, they're just not going to do well in Orange County. You need a bridge builder. You can't have a bridge burner as your party standard bearer and expect to do well. Just like, when Obama was seen as the head of the Democratic Party, you didn't see places like Kentucky or West Virginia going too well, because people in those areas just do not like what they see coming out of Washington. And same could be said about Orange County. They just don't like what they see coming out of Washington. And they responded. I mean, one of the big issues in New Jersey and California was the salt tax. And the Republicans had basically raised taxes on large segments of populations in places like Orange County, where the cost of living is extremely high. And those voters said, well, if you can't even keep our taxes, why should we vote for you? And they sent a message and, picked somebody that at least ostensibly, did not feel that raising the salt tax was the appropriate way of doing business.
Yes. Well, Tim, give us some more findings from across the country that you researched this past
week.
Yeah,
I want to give you some real surprising stuff. Now, you've heard that the turnout was close to 50%. It's 116 million voters. That's the highest turnout percentage-wise since 1914, when there was like 50.4% that voted in that election, with no female voters, by the way. 25 states over 50% voted. Just shocking for a midterm. 5 states had over 60%. Colorado, Minnesota, Montana, Oregon, Wisconsin. There's one reason Walker lost. One state, get this, had over 65% of the voters to vote. Arizona. What happened in Arizona? Well, Kyrsten Sinema is what happened in Arizona. If you break down the vote by white voters, 54-44 for the Republicans, and basically that's the only group that they won. They lost Hispanic voters by 40 points. They lost black voters by 81 points. They lost Asian Americans 77-23. And a lot of these voters, like over a fourth of the Hispanics who voted, and that was 11% of the vote, guys, they were first-time voters in a midterm. 18% of black voters were first-time voters. 12% of the white vote was first-time voters. Most of them were young, and they voted Democratic. A majority of the voters under the age of 30 were first-time voters. Young voters came out, and women came out in droves. Pick one state out, Virginia. Tim Kaine got two-thirds of the female vote in that state. If anybody gets two-thirds of the female vote in any state, you know, they're going to get elected. Pick another state out, Nevada. I mean, we wipe Republicans out in that state. It's a very diverse electorate out there now, and it produced a big Democratic win. Two female senators, total Democratic control of the state government, a female majority on the state Supreme Court, a female majority in one house of their state legislature. Women did very well among Democrats. They did very well, David. That thing you sent to me, 29 new House Democrats are female from the Democratic Party and only one Republican. This was the year of the woman in a big way. And a final stat I want to throw on you guys. Democrats won the female vote by 19 points in congressional races. What do you think?
It was quite a trend shuffling election. And Steen, I'm going to have a question for you since you won't get to be on here every week and give your thoughts on the future. This election was very much a referendum on Donald Trump. And in areas where he was, you know, had some demographic popularity, like North Dakota and Missouri and places like that, he did okay. In places like the suburbs and new emerging states like Arizona, he didn't do so well. So if you're Donald Trump looking at this map, knowing that Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin were essential to your victory in 2016, and you lost all three of those. Arizona's a state you carried, and you lost that. Texas and Georgia, the largest two Republican states, were within a point pretty much of the biggest two races, the U.S. Senate and the governor's race respectively, and will only trend more Democratic, at least is the natural trend. What would you be thinking?
Well, I think that, you know, the president's going to have to depend on his Midwestern states that he carried first and foremost. He's got to have Wisconsin again. He's got to have Ohio and Iowa and so on. And he's going to have to either evaluate, does it make more sense to try to go back into a Nevada or go back into a, I mean, certainly Arizona and Georgia will remain competitive, but, you know, Nevada, Colorado, Virginia, you know, do you even make the effort at this point, or do you try to find a state like a Minnesota that you can maybe go after and have a little bit more success? If Trump were to hypothetically be reelected, which is probably not likely right now, he would have to run the table and win by a very small margin by carrying your Floridas and your Georgias by, you know, probably very similar margins to how the Republicans won the states this time. There's something to be said for, you know, is this the floor for the Republicans? Is this, you know, this is the worst they can do, or can it get worse? And that's obviously a big question, because if Abrams or you know, for example, is, or Chris and Sinema, Arizona, are the high water mark, then that's probably okay for the Republicans. If they're not, then you have deeper problems. Now, Arizona, you know, I will say the Republican governor of Arizona won easily. So it's not as if Arizona was a total wipeout, but you know he's gonna have to watch his flank, so to speak. He cannot depend on states that you know are reliably Republican to stay that way in many cases.
Hey, guys, yeah, I need to jump in with a question.
Sure,
I need to jump in with a question if I can. And looking at some of this data, I'm seeing in states like Ohio and Missouri. Let's take Missouri. McCaskill lost the white vote there, 57-42, and she lost the race. But that's in a state where 84% of the vote is white. It seems that the Republicans, where they are winning now, they're only surviving as a whites-only party. Are they going to survive nationally like that?
True, they won't. House of Representatives, where you have to win throughout the nation, it's can they figure out that electoral strategy to hold on another time or two while they can somehow figure out how to do what the 2012 autopsy said, you got to diversify the party. Somebody that we're probably not a big fan of is Democrats. Karl Rove, he knew that they had to diversify their party way back in 2000, 2002, 2004. But Donald Trump, that's not the model he won on, so he's not going to do it. And some of his, you know, top advisors like Stephen Miller see no interest in that. Steen, you mentioned Minnesota. And I think Tim and I saw that same piece on Political Wire saying that that's going to be a target. Democrats won every single statewide race, including Attorney General, where Keith Ellison had had quite a kind of cloud hanging over his head, and yet he still won. And I think he won a lot because of the Democratic brand being so strong in Minnesota. They won both Senate mm-hmm. races. If Minnesota is mm-hmm. your target, do you really have any target?
Well, I think, like I said, my previous answer still stands that he would not be favored to be reelected just based on his approval ratings. But, you mm-hmm. know, obviously we're entering a new dynamic where you have a divided Congress now. He's not going to have Paul Ryan to deal with and kick around anymore. So he's going to have to figure out how to – well, I mean, if he's smart, he's got to figure out how to get something in his agenda passed, even though he doesn't have a friendly Congress entirely anymore. And then, you know, obviously who knows what's going to happen with the country. We could have, you know, change in economic circumstances. We could have some international crisis or, you know, other domestic crisis props up and – you know, we don't know what the Supreme Court's going to do. Obviously, we have, you know, new judges that are, you know, more conservative courts. So, you know, anything can change. But, I mean, obviously, just given that we just had an election and the Democrats won the generic ballot, you know, nationally by about 8-9 points, he would not be favored for reelection right now. And that's, you know, he's got a tough road to go. But, I mean, he had a tough road in 2016 and he basically threaded the needle. And he carried three states, and really that was it. And really it was just Pennsylvania that really did it, if my memory serves me. But with that Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin was really that was it in Florida. So, you know, he wants to claim that he won an incredible, you know, dominating victory. But really, you know, he's one of the less popular presidents to begin with. And obviously that standing has not improved at all. Since taking office, except among Republicans who you would hope would support their own president if you're a Republican.
Yeah, Steve, I mean, Donald Trump mentioned the kind of guy on his ego, he wants to, Tim, I was going to say, let me ask you a question. He's the kind of guy, he wants to compare himself to Abraham Lincoln and George Washington and give himself an A. If you said, hey, you're more like Rutherford B. Hayes, he'd probably say who?
because he wouldn't even know who that person was. Tim, I'm sorry. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, there's another troubling point. Stane, you mentioned, of course, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, a lot of Catholics up that way. Well, in the last midterms, the Republicans won the Catholic vote in this country by 10 vote points. Well, the other night, the Democrats won the Catholic vote by a percentage point. And we saw what happened in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania in the election the other night. Is there any way Donald Trump could win those states if he does not win the Catholic vote?
Well, if my memory serves me, I don't know if he won the Catholic vote in those states or not. I don't remember a breakdown by religious belief, but I do know that he cannot win it without doing very well among non-college whites. And, you know, while Republicans did okay in some parts of the country with that, for example, in Pennsylvania, the Senate and Democratic senator and governor won pretty handily. While carrying probably a significant portion of people who voted for Trump. I mean, they would have had to based on the numbers. So, you know, when you have Republicans that are voting for, well, not even Republicans, when you have people that are voting for Sherrod Brown and Bob Casey and Tom Wolf and, you know, Senator Debbie Stabenow in Michigan and people, you know, people like that, and then they also voted for Trump, you know, he's going to have to convince those people to stick with him. And I don't know.
So,
you know, I don't know how that's going to go.
So you're talking about the working class white vote that was
pretty much, or people in the suburbs that split ticket as well. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Well, Stina, I think it's 8 o'clock. So, want to thank you for coming on the Cozy Vine this evening.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate it, and great to have everybody together to talk about these issues.
Thank
Certainly
you, Steve.
So.
Good night, everybody.
We're definitely going to call you on again. Good night, everybody.
Perfect. Thank you.
We are the heirs of that first revolution
with a strong and...
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.